Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Osman Family JCC Center in Palo Alto. My name is Diana Diamond. It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Madeleine Albright, author of her new book, Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. It is already a bestseller. Throughout her distinguished diplomatic career, Dr. Albright has been a voice of strength and reason during some of the world's most historic events. She also was a leader in advancing professional opportunities for women in international affairs and public service. And to that I say hooray. Dr. Albright was born in Czechoslovakia, where her father, Joseph Korbel, was a member of the Czech diplomatic service. The family traveled through Europe and then eventually ended up here in the United States after receiving political asylum. Dr. Albright got her degree from Wellesley College and graduated with honors, and then went on to get her master's and doctorate degrees from Columbia University's Department of Public Law and Government. She served as a legislative liaison on the National Security Council staff under President Jimmy Carter, and was appointed U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations by President Bill Clinton. In 1997, she was nominated and unanimously confirmed by the state Senate as the 64th Secretary of State, which is the way we all know her, I think. With this honor, Dr. Albright became the first female to ever hold this position and was at that time the highest-ranking female in U.S. history. Last year, President Obama presented Dr. Albright with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. A best-selling author, Madeleine Albright is professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. She is also chair of Albright Capital Management and the Albright Stonebridge Group. Moderating this night's conversation is Roy Eisenhart, a retired attorney and a lecturer at University of California, Berkeley. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Madeleine Albright and Roy Eisenhart.
Good evening, Madam Secretary.
Very good to be here with you and everybody else.
That's right. And I want to add my welcome to you. And I think that applause was saying several things to you. One is to thank you for being here tonight. The second is to thank you for all the work you did, both in the United Nations and in the State Department on behalf of our country. But the third, and what we're going to really talk about tonight, is the way since you left government you've used your experience and insight to help inform us about everything from how personal experience has come to bear on political decisions to helping us understand this very confusing world that we live in today. And this is a really important value in my judgment, because people like you who are so clear and so thinking are what we don't have enough of right now. So hopefully this evening is going to give us all three phases of that applause for you.
Thank you.
So thank you.
I'm
going to spend most of the time in our little chit-chat regarding your book, because I know that when we get to audience questions that they're going to be on many of the current events and so forth. But your book is not simply a memoir. Your book informs us as to history, and it also informs us as to how we think about things today. So I'd like to really start with an explanation of it that you carry forward yourself, which is it's really a thematic weaving of several themes. And I would ask you, maybe as a starting point, to explain the different layers within that book.
Thank you very much, and I'm really very, very happy to be here and to have a chance to have this discussion. The book really kind of comes in three layers. The inner story is the story of my family. My father was a Czechoslovak diplomat, and we spent the war in England because he was with the government in exile. It also explores my own family story. I was raised a Catholic, married an Episcopalian, and found out I was Jewish. So, and it kind of goes through that story and explains, and then it traced to what happened to many large numbers of my family. The second layer is about World War II and the various events that took place, why they took place, how major powers treat small countries, and the consequences of that. And then the third layer, in many ways, is most complicated because it talks about the difficulties of making morally correct decisions. And we have a sense that everything is kind of black and white, but it's not. There are an awful lot of gray areas, and how decisions are made, what the trade-offs are, and how one thinks one would behave in particular situations, and you never know whether you will or not. So it's those three layers pulled together. I did a lot of research. I had done some of this story in my memoirs, Madam Secretary, but I hadn't really gone into enough detail. Also, when I went to Prague, I had gone many times, but when I went for a research trip, there's an institute there for the study of totalitarian governments, which is where the secret police files from the communist period have been deposited. So they gave me my father's secret police record. And the major problem was that he was constantly being accused of being a pro-Western Democrat. But it was strange to know that they had tracked us for a long time. And then the Foreign Ministry gave me his personnel files. I spent a lot of time talking to people that did know him. And when I did research in England, he broadcast over BBC to Czechoslovakia. So BBC had a lot of records. So I spent a lot of time doing research for it.
Wow. That's what is it like to go back and reconstruct your life over a period when you were roughly 2 years old or so when you moved to England, and over that 11-year period?
Well, it's interesting because I start out the book by saying I was 59 years old and I thought I knew who I was, who my people were, and what the country was that I'd come from. But it turns out actually that I didn't. And while I knew a lot of the things that I'd been told as a child, I obviously didn't remember things from when I was really little. I did remember an awful lot of things from the war, and then my father, after the war, was ambassador to Yugoslavia. And I did know a lot about that. What I was trying to do was to fit in the new facts to what I already had known. And so I think one of the things that has come up often is, how did I even find out about the Jewish background? And what happened was that when I became ambassador of the United Nations and became a public figure, all of a sudden there were profiles of me which generated letters, and I started getting letters from the Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic later, of people who'd say, I'm your relative, send money, or I need a visa. And then I got some letters that never had all the facts right. You know, somebody would say, I'd gone to high school with your father in 1915, which would have been impossible since he was born in 1909, and just facts wrong. But in 96, like November 96, I got a letter from somebody that had all the names right, the dates right, the villages right, saying my family knew your family and they were a fine Jewish family. So what happened, this was just the time that my name was out there to be Secretary of State and I was being vetted. And I was with the White House counsel and they were asking me the normal questions like, had I paid my taxes and did I have a nanny? And then at the end, they said to me, well, we ask everybody this question. Is there anything about yourself that you would like to tell us that we didn't ask you? I said, well, I just got this letter, and it's perfectly possible that I'm of Jewish background. And they said, so what? The president is not anti-Semitic. So over the holidays, I spoke to my, I have three daughters, all of whom were married, and we I told them what I had learned, and they loved my parents and had already been kind of fascinated by the very exotic life that they had led. And so this added to their general interest and knowledge. You are not allowed to talk to the press between the time that you've been named and the time you're confirmed. But a reporter, Michael Dobbs, wanted to do a profile of me. So my office gave him names of people that he could get in touch with. And the first week that I was secretary, he came into my office and started putting these disgusting documents in front of me, which were the records that the Nazis kept of people they'd sent to concentration camps. And I look at these, and I couldn't believe, you know, the names, various names from my family. And that's how I learned about that they'd been sent to concentration camps. It's one thing to find out you're Jewish. It's another to find out that more than two dozen of my relatives had actually died in concentration camps. And there is... I've been asked, and I tried to write about this, is what it felt like. I had just been named Secretary of State and is very kindly introduced, you know, the first woman Secretary of State. People didn't think a woman could be Secretary of State. And I was trying to prove I could actually do that. At the same time, this news had come out. It also came out in the Washington Post, and I was accused of lying that I had known, which I had not. And so there was such a mixture of feelings in terms of what was going on. And I couldn't go to examine the story myself because I did have to work. So I asked my brother and sister to go. And they met this wonderful man who's head of the Jewish community in Prague who took them around and began to put the story together. But I didn't think that it was sufficient. And so after I'd written my other books, I thought that I wanted to go back to this and really put the pieces together and fit it into the parts of my life that I knew. So but I did remember an awful lot from being in London during the Blitz and being bombed in, I think the thing you and I were saying, we're about the same age, and what makes me different from you is that I actually lived through being bombed and coming out of a cellar in the morning and seeing smoke coming out of buildings and then going back to Czechoslovakia and then to Yugoslavia. The picture, the little girl who gives flowers at the airport in a national costume, that's what I did for a living. I was a diplomat's daughter, and I remember all that, and meeting Tito and doing kinds of diplomatic work as a child.
You're right. Not many people can... or want to say that they've lived through a bombing, and you actually describe in the book the sensation of the first the V1 bombs and then the V2s coming over London. Could you maybe elaborate
well,
on that?
Well, I think that the thing is that they had these terrible sounds, and part of the problem with the doodlebugs, the V2s, is that they screeched, but you knew by then it was too late, and you kind of were trying to figure out what had happened. We were in London during the Blitz, and then moved out to a little town called Walton-on-Thames. My father was an air raid warden, I remember his coming into the house he broke his glasses on a stone pillar and in a blackout trying to figure out what to do or how one really lived, through, generally how you adjusted your life to being in air raid shelters and hearing these sounds and knowing. And then one thing that they developed there at the time was iron tables that we had in our dining room in this house. And you ate on it, you played around it, you slept under it, because people said that if your house were hit and you were under it, you would be saved. So this iron table was kind of central to our lives.
One of the things that both come through your book, both in the description of this period of your life and the description of the people of Czechoslovakia during the German occupation, is the resilience of human nature. And I wonder if you could...
Well, I think that's the lesson out of the book. I mean, I have to say, it's for those of you that haven't read it yet, it's not a happy story. I mean... it describes the horrors of people being sent to concentration camps and what Terezin was like, which was this sadistic place that had been kind of sold to the Jews, saying, you're in a ghetto in Prague, wouldn't you prefer to kind of be in this nice spa-like place? And I go through all that and describe not just my family, but other people being... Terezin was not a death camp, but it was a transport camp. So what happened to people and the horrible stories. But I do come out in the end in terms of the resilience of people that had lived through World War II and were putting their lives back together after the war and trying to figure out how to put the pieces back together. And I think that's the part in the end that is uplifting about the book, I hope.
It is. And it also demonstrated to me, at least, the difficulty of countries trying to impose their geopolitical will unilaterally on smaller nations and the difficulty of doing that. And the Czech Republic was a perfect example of that.
Well, that's one of the real tragedies. And I had always known about Munich. I grew up with what I'd heard and read about Munich. In writing the book now, I added to it a little bit my own knowledge of what it's like to be a decision maker. And something that I had never appreciated was how tired the British and French were from World War I. They had lost a whole generation of young men. And Neville Chamberlain has always been kind of in the pantheon of odious figures as far as I'm concerned. But I can understand what was going on in terms of his desire to do anything not to go to war again. And what did happen, and this is a real lesson, is that the British and French made a deal with the Germans and Italians over the head of the Czechoslovaks. They were not at the table at Munich. And sold the country down the river. And it really makes you look at decision-making. The United States wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And one of the threads of my life has really been is when the U.S. is not there, which U.S. was not at Munich, terrible things happened. When the United States entered the war, everything was reversed. I remember seeing American soldiers and people cheering about that. And then at the end of the war, when General Patton only got as far as Plzeň, 45 miles in, and as a result of agreements made during World War II, the Soviets were allowed to liberate Czechoslovakia, and the United States didn't. That changed everything, and the country was behind the Iron Curtain for 50 years. So that has had a huge effect on my life in terms of my thinking about what the role of the United States is.
And you have the picture in the book of Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin at Yalta, and that's where that decision ended up being made, right? Let's go back to Chamberlain. Somehow I don't feel as though it gets him off the hook, just the notion that the Germans and French, English and French were tired. I mean, that transaction, I'll call it, that he effectuated over... without, as you say, the participation of the Czechoslovakian government, it just strikes me as awful.
I think it was awful. I have tried to be a fair analyst. And the reason I said what I said is that I'd never really considered that part of it. I had grown up thinking that it was a treasonous act as far as the country where I was born was concerned. And kind of statements that echo very much, which are, why should we care about people in faraway places with unpronounceable names? And I think very much a sense that it was not the British responsibility or the French. And then also, what I find very hard is to recognize that there were quite a few British people that were pro-German. Mm-hmm. The American ambassador, Joseph Kennedy, was pro-German. And I think that is was hard for me to absorb. But I do think that one has to think the word appeasement kind of fits with that whole period. And there's so many parts to Munich. I think what's interesting is to think about this is a simplification of debates that we had during the Clinton administration. I was definitely had the Munich syndrome, which is that you don't give in. And then people that were 10 years younger than I am had the Vietnam syndrome, which was that you don't get involved. And so it's kind of interesting to figure out how that plays out.
Well, if you fast forward that then to the Iraq situation, you had the notion that any type of efforts to negotiate or were appeasement and got labeled with the Chamberlain label. And so that I think that, as you point out, and I'm just reinforcing it, that the concept, Chamberlain has become a bigger than life concept for the notion of appeasement. You mentioned at the beginning the issue around moral decision making, and there are several examples of that in the book that are very teaching, are teaching moments. And one of them has to do with the German or Nazi leader named Heydrich.
Well, this is what an unbelievable story and a case of this is that what had happened was that as a result of Munich, Czechoslovakia was divided. The Slovaks became independent under a pro-German leader, and the Czechs and the Moravians were under a Reichsprotector. And the not the initial one, but a second one, was this man Heydrich, who was kind of the number three guy in among the Nazis and partially the inventor of the Holocaust. The Czechoslovak government was in London, government in exile, with President Beneš there as head of it, but it never was really recognized by the British, or wasn't immediately, and partially because it meant a renunciation of Munich, which they were not prepared to do, and some other kind of legal issues. And President Beneš and that group there kept trying to prove their worth to the British as being part of the Allied cause. And as a series of decisions, it was decided that a group of Czechs would be training with the RAF in order to do any number of kind of commando things in the Czech, in the Bohemian part. And among those things was to train to assassinate Heydrich. And so what happened was they did, in fact, parachute in and hid for quite a long time among people, got the kind of the lay of the land, and they did assassinate Heydrich. It was the only assassination of a high-level Nazi throughout the entire war. But as a result of it, what happened was the Germans ordered the destruction of an entire town, Lidice. So thousands of people died. I found out in the course of my research that they also were rounding up Jews, and among them was my maternal grandmother. And so the issue was, and then what happened was that the British really did see the value of this government in exile. They recognized them, and it changed the level of discussion. But the question is, was it worth it? You know, was it the right thing to do that all these thousands of people died in order to assassinate Heydrich? I think in the end it was the right decision, but it's that kind of a moral dilemma. The other part about the dilemma is that it's a part of the book that I think is almost like a spy story of some kind, but there were those who collaborated with those who actually then found these parachutists that had hidden, and the question is, why did those people collaborate? And I ask myself in some cases whether you might collaborate if somebody told you you would save your own family if you told them where these people are. And you figure, maybe I should tell him because the other guy's going to tell him, and meanwhile, my family will die. Or are there people that actually committed suicide so that they wouldn't have to tell? And so it raised a lot of questions for me. I think we all have these moments where you wonder how you would behave under very hard circumstances. And, you know, if you're a POW, or you would hope that you would behave well, but you never know. And so I, throughout the book, kind of ask myself, How would people have behaved? How would I have behaved? How do you behave? Do you collaborate or do you denounce? Or how? I think those are very, very hard questions.
And I assume there was not a form reaction within the Czechoslovakian people even as how to do it.
There was not. I do not think. And I think that, and there had been other decisions that were made that were hard. One of them was after the Munich Agreement, there had been a desire by many people to mobilize and fight back against the Germans. And my father was a young man, and he was mobilized at the time, and the question was whether the Czechs would fight. And I think many Czechs were prepared to fight, Czechoslovaks, and then Beneš decided not to. And there was a value judgment as to whether it was better to not fight and survive and know that ultimately there would be a world war where, in fact, others would come in, but at the time people weren't ready to. So it's those kinds of things I try to examine.
The point you make, it's so critical, and it really becomes even more clear to me as you say it, about the decision to stop Patton at the border and to allow Czechoslovakia, at that time, Czechoslovakia, to be taken over by Russia.
Well, in many ways, it's even more complicated and troubling than that. What happened was Czechoslovakia during the interwar period was a very interesting place, the only real democracy in Central and Eastern Europe. It was a country that was founded on the basis of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. And what is interesting, the first president of Czechoslovakia, married an American, and her name was Charlotte Gehrig. And he took her maiden name as his middle name. Not a lot of people do that.
They had an equal rights clause.
And the Constitution had an equal rights clause in it in 1918. And what was interesting also was that this was very much of a kind of middle-class, working-class country. All the nobles had been thrown out the window in 1348. So, defenestration was... But at the time, what was interesting was that it was a country that had both a legal communist party and a legal socialist party. And so during the war, what happened was a group of the Czechoslovaks went to London and a group of them went to Moscow and came very much under the influence of the Soviet Union. President Beneš, and I think this is also an interesting lesson, there had been a non-aggression treaty that the Czechoslovaks had signed with France, saying that if Czechoslovakia was ever attacked, France would come and defend them. The Soviet Union also had a treaty that said if the French came in to defend Czechoslovakia, the Russians would come in too. So what happened was that the French didn't come in. The Russians then had always said they had an excuse because the French had not. And so in many ways, that many Czechoslovaks felt disappointed by the Western reaction of Munich, and were not like the Poles who disliked the Russians automatically, kind of felt that Russia was Mother Russia. And so there was this division right away of those who felt that Russia had been fairer to them than the West. And that affected what happened after the war. And interestingly enough, the first elections in 1946, the communists actually won a plurality. And partially the communists could argue that they had played a large role during the resistance, that they had fought. Some of this was all propaganda, but that was what was going on. In addition, with the Social Democrats, they did form the first government. The first prime minister was a Social Democrat. And what Stalin, who had been slowly but surely acquiring a satellite empire, had thought was that Czechoslovakia actually could become communist by vote, by election. And so they planned to win a majority in 1948. But what was happening was that people began to be kind of disillusioned by the communist promises, and it looked as though they were not going to win in 1948. So then through a series of very complicated maneuvers, ultimately, there was a coup.
Yeah.
And that was another decision, whether President Beneš should have accepted the complicated story, the resignation of some democratic ministers. So there are those kind of moments in the book that I talk about.
As you said at the outset, your book is a history of World War II, but it's really a lesson about how to think today about the issues we're facing. And one of them that came to mind as you were telling that story has to do with inspections, because that seems to be the device du jour for monitoring. And you go back to Terezin that you mentioned earlier.
Well, thank you for picking up on that one, because I think it's a very interesting lesson. As I said, Terezin was set up as this real hypocrisy in the making of this place that was supposed to be nice, that Jews would feel comfortable in. And I don't know whether any, I'm sure people here have been there. It's kind of composed of two parts. It was a fort that was set up during the Austro-Hungarian Empire in honor of Empress Teresa. And Gavrilo Princip, the person that had assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, had actually been incarcerated there. So there was a fortress that was a prison. But then there was a town. And the town, I've since been there, obviously, and it was a nice town with big buildings and a square in the middle with grass and everything. And so the people are transported there, and then terrible conditions exist. And what happened was the Red Cross wanted to come and inspect it. And so the rulers of the camp, the keepers of it, had cleaned up a whole part of it and rebuilt certain sections. And they then invited the Red Cross inspectors in. As a result of some kind of mistakes, whoever went in there were not people that were properly trained to know what they were looking for, and they gave it a clean bill of health. And so I have thought about the lessons where we now have various inspectors that go to inspect aspects to do with the nuclear potential of Iran, or human rights inspectors, mm-hmm. how much the international community counts on people being properly trained and knowing what they're supposed to be looking for, and then telling the truth. Because I think that was one of the really tragic parts, is that that they were kind of fooled by the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that happened to us in Iraq?
That is what they say, right?
Yeah.
But that is a little bit different. I think that what happened, let me tell you my sense. I spent an awful lot of time on Iraq. When I was sent to the United Nations in February 1993, was after the Gulf War, and the sanctions resolutions had been the translation of the ceasefire. And a lot of them had to do with making sure that weapons of mass destruction were destroyed. And the truth is that there were inspectors, international inspectors, that went in there, and they actually destroyed more weapons than the Gulf War itself. And they would come back to the UN and report on what had been done. What happened was that in 1998, the inspectors were thrown out, and there was not yet a full accounting of whether all the weapons had been destroyed. So I have to admit that I was willing to believe myself, when we were already out of office and this question came up, that there might still be weapons of mass destruction there. I, however, believed that we had Saddam Hussein in a box and that he did not have the capability of delivering or threatening us with his weapons of mass destruction. As it turns out, there were no weapons of mass destruction. And so one of the issues that we always depend on is the clarity of our intelligence and how it is created. And I think that one of the great tragedies of recent years is that we went to war over what was not there.
That's a powerful statement. I am going to do something that George Bush the First did and got in a lot of trouble for, and that's look at my watch, because I don't want to encroach on the audience question time. And we have about 5 minutes, so I'm going to ask you, in anticipation of the fact there will be a lot of current events questions, to give us your umbrella overview of the major issues that you see facing world peace right now.
I did write a previous book when I... it was called Memo to the President-Elect, at a time I had no idea who that person was going to be. I ultimately did give it to Barack Obama, and I inscribed it with the moment that I said, with the audacity to hope that this book might be useful. I did, in fact, outline what I called were five big umbrella issues that I thought any president-elect would face 4 years ago. And it was how to fight terrorism without creating more terrorists, how to deal with the problems of nuclear proliferation, how to deal with the growing problem of the gap between the rich and the poor internationally. There is no direct line between poverty and terrorism, but it's not hard to imagine that people who are disenfranchised or alienated from their society are more recruitable. Then the fourth issue was that kind of whole grouping of energy, environment, pandemic, disease, and then how to restore the good name of democracy. Those were five big umbrella issues. I didn't have the financial crisis in there yet because it was not evident. And then I also looked at what were some of the regional issues that would be out there as problems. Obviously, the Middle East. And then what was Middle East writ large in terms of Israeli-Palestinian issues and Iran. Then Pakistan. I think Pakistan has everything that gives you an international migraine. Nuclear weapons, poverty, terrorism, extremism, corruption, a weak government in a very bad location. And they are mad at us. And so... And then I had thought already, and the Clinton administration began to be in this direction of thinking that our major strategic relationship was going to be with China, and I think that that is very much so now. I think what we had not, any of us, at least I didn't foresee at that particular time, was what is now going on in Northwest Africa and kind of this belt of the split-offs of Al-Qaeda and various other terrorist movements. And then I think that we never pay enough attention to Latin America. Not easy, because we never can quite get it right. We either pay no attention to them and they think we ignore them, or we pay too much attention to them and they think we're meddling in their affairs. So there is a huge number of things to do. Yeah. And I think the hardest part for a president and a secretary of state is prioritizing. And now, of course, we have the problems of a threat of no money. So I think that there are many, many issues that are out there for everybody to handle.
Could I be so bold as to add another one, and that's the dysfunctional relationship between the executive and legislative?
Yes, I would. Let me just say, I have worked both on Capitol Hill. I worked for Ed Muskie as a legislative assistant, and I worked in the Carter administration and the Clinton administration. I teach about, or I have taught about executive legislative relations, and I practice them from both angles. And I think we have an amazing system of government. I do believe in the whole situation about advise and consent. When I teach about it, our Constitution is written, it's often called an invitation to struggle. It's slightly gone overboard at the moment. I do think that I am very troubled. I think that the President has laid out a series of plans. He's given an inaugural address in a State of the Union. And I do think Congress has a job in terms of its responsibilities of oversight and of advice and consent on nominations. But I believe it needs to be done with a process of goodwill, not out of pique or some other aspect of it. And I have to say this. I'm chairman of the board of an organization called the National Democratic Institute, actually started by Ronald Reagan in the 80s. Because he was saying that democracies were not real good about explaining ourselves vis-a-vis communism. So he gave a speech in London at Westminster, came back and started the National Endowment for Democracy that has a democratic institute, a Republican one, business and labor. And we are in about 70 countries at this point talking about nuts and bolts of democracy. And so we've been in various places and we say, well, part of democracy is having an opposition party, compromise, coalition building, and they say, yeah, like you guys. So it's we are not doing what I think we should be doing, is providing an example of how democracies function.
Well, I know I'm going to go to these questions, and while I get my artificial eyes together here, you don't have to wear these.
Wait, I do.
I'm going to ask you a question that I know is probably in here, the reason I want to ask it now is to give myself time, but also to follow on what you just said, and that was your observations on the Hegel confirmation.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think we have felt basically that a president has a right to appoint his or her own cabinet, and I know Senator Hegel very well. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee when I was Secretary of State, and I worked with him, and we have done a number of things since then. He's been head of the Atlantic Council, and I, among the various things I was asked to do by this administration, was to look for a new strategic concept for NATO, so I worked with him on that, and he teaches at Georgetown, as do I, so we've taught some classes together. So I think he is a remarkable public servant, and that he is perfectly qualified to be Secretary of Defense. And I think that what is going on is not helpful and damaging in many different ways and completely unnecessary.
Yeah. Well, which leads me to a question that's in here because it's tied into that, and it has to do with Benghazi. And your analysis of that from two points of view, that the diplomatic security question and then the, what I will call the politicization of the issue.
Well, let me just say, anybody who knows me knows that I loved being Secretary of State, except on August 7th, 1998, when our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were blown up. And I went there as soon as I could. There are various things in life that I never thought I would do, but one I really never thought I would do was to bring American bodies back to the United States. And I will never forget being in a cargo plane with the coffins, and I had fallen asleep, and there was a tarp, and when I woke up, there I was sitting among the coffins, and they were all covered with American flags. And so this weighed very heavily. What had happened? So the same thing that's just happened on Benghazi, there was a board appointed in order to investigate how this had happened, and recommendations in terms of trying to get better coordination in the State Department about how the security people work with the political people. And ultimately what happened was every single day the diplomatic security people would come in to talk to me and say, today we saw an unidentified Vespa in front of the embassy in Athens. What do you want to do about it? Or somebody came in and gave us some information that X would happen in some country. Don't you think we should do something about it? The bottom line, I hate to say this, but I wasn't qualified to make that decision. I think that's why you have security experts that help you get through this. I don't know what happened in terms of the procedures that we established during the Clinton administration and what they really were during the Bush administration, and also in terms of diplomatic security is essential. The other part that happened was even before that, when our embassy in Beirut was attacked during the Reagan period, there had already begun to be a program of building these buildings that actually looked like forts, and they were called the Inman buildings, and so there began to be all kinds of rules about what our embassies should look like, and I'm sure that many people here visited some of these embassies. The job of an ambassador in an embassy is to be the eyes and ears of the President of the United States. And sitting there behind high walls, it does not exactly help the process. And so the question is how to protect the diplomats and at the same time have them do their job. Obviously things went wrong in Benghazi, and I think that an awful lot of, and this review board looked again at a series of recommendations that had to be made. I think that it is my belief, according to what I've read, is that the administration has shown Congress, well, Secretary Clinton testified, Secretary Panetta testified, they also provided all kinds of thousands of pages of documentation, and nobody wants to know more about what's gone on than the administration. So to hold up people over that doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm sure, I know what it's like to be responsible for this, is that everybody's trying to figure out how not to have this happen again.
I think one fact, if I get this right, that helps put it in perspective is to give us the relative budgets of the State Department and the Department of Defense.
Well, this, you know, the State Department budget, which is in order to pay the diplomats, build the buildings, have the programs, and also USAID is $51 billion. The budget for the Defense Department, depending upon how many, whether you count things off budget or on budget, is something like $700 billion.
Yeah.
A little bit different. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem, I know what happened when I was there. I went up, part of the report that was made about the Kenyan-Tanzania episodes said that we should spend $10 billion over several years to rebuild the embassies. So when I went up and testified, I said, before I've come here and I've told you that you're asking me to rob Peter to pay Paul, now you're asking me to rob Paul too. There was nothing, you had a choice of either having, and one of the things that happens, we have created new embassies, that you can either have ambassadors sitting behind high walls outside of town, mm-hmm. or you can, with no programs because there's no money for them, or you have programs of people somewhere that are not properly protected. Mm-hmm. And those are terrible choices to have to make. Mm-hmm. Secretary Kerry just gave his first speech in which he talked about the problem of how small the budget is for the State Department. And one of the things, I've said this for a very long time, I think most people, and he repeated this in his speech, most people think that we spend something like 20% of our federal budget on foreign aid. And so people say that's terrible, and so you say, well, how much do you think we should spend? And they say, well, about 10%. We actually spend 1%.
Wow.
And I also would stop talking about foreign aid. Yeah. It's like putting two words together, selling some horrible disease.
Yeah.
And that it should be called national security support. Because the kinds of things that our money goes to is to try to create some kind of stability in various countries.
Yeah, foreign aid almost has a colonial sound.
Yeah.
Several questions on North Korea. Am I right that you were the highest-ranking member of our government to visit North Korea?
What happened, and the North Korean story has obviously been going on a very long time. I mean, from the end of World War II and the Korean War and the division of the Korean Peninsula. I don't know where you were in the Marines. You've probably been to the DMZ. And a very peculiar place where, in fact, there is a string down the table in Panmunjom where, in fact, the negotiations took place dividing North and South Korea. We have been trying to figure out what to do about North Korea for decades. I kind of came into the story in 93 when we got to the UN. They had been signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and we're pulling out of it, and we were trying to figure out how not to have that happen. I won't go through the whole story, but they had wanted to develop more of their nuclear program. We were trying to stop them from doing it. We went back and forth in a number of different negotiations. And the summer of 2000, Vice Marshal Cho, the number two man there, came to the United States. I met with him, and then we were in the Oval Office, and he was there in his uniform with medals for killing Americans. We had this red folder, and he was giving it to President Clinton, saying that it was an invitation for him to come and visit North Korea. And President Clinton said, well, it's not appropriate for me to go, but the Secretary of State will go, which did not make them particularly happy. We had no embassy there, so I had no idea what I was in for. And we knew very little about Kim Jong-il. Mm-hmm. Our intelligence said he was crazy and a pervert.
In which order?
Well, I went there. He's not crazy. But the thing that happened is, because I had no idea what was going to happen, I get there, they put me in the guest house, and I just sit there. And all of a sudden, a message comes saying that I had to go and see his embalmed father. So I went and did that. And then I come back, and they say, now the dear leader will see you. And so we had a press conference, and we're standing there together, and I look over, we're about the same height. I knew I had on high heels, and I looked over, he had on high heels, and his hair was a lot poofier than mine. But the thing that was so interesting is we had about 12 hours of talks, and I found out that he actually was very smart and was able, we had discussions about missile limits and moratoria and signing things that we had no hostile intent towards each other. We were in the middle of negotiations. When I left. Now, many Americans were confused by the election of 2000, and so one can't blame him for having been confused. I hold no brief for Kim Jong-il. He was an evil dictator. But we were in the middle of negotiations. Colin Powell was wanting to continue the kinds of things that we were negotiating. Headline in the Washington Post said, Powell to continue Clinton policies. He was hauled into the Oval Office and told, no way. So those particular talks were cut off. But we have gone back and forth. There are lots of discussions about this. And let me just, if I might, lay something out. I teach a course at Georgetown. I say foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. That's all it is. Yeah. So what is the toolbox? The course I teach is called the National Security Toolbox. Mm-hmm. And there are not a lot of tools in there. There's bilateral diplomacy and multilateral diplomacy and the economic tools, which are aid and trade, the carrots or sanctions and embargoes, which are the sticks, the threat of the use of force, law enforcement and intelligence, that's it. So we are trying to change the behavior of North Korea. So we have tried bilateral diplomacy. We are continue to try multilateral diplomacy, which are the six-party talks, where we hope that the Chinese will have some kind of influence on them. We have tried the carrots. We gave them some food assistance and also at a certain stage tried to have a deal where we would be selling crude oil to them so they didn't think they'd have to build the nuclear reactors. And we have tried sanctions. We have sanctions on North Korea now, and will probably enlarge them. We have threatened the use of force. We did that. We have not used force since the Korean War, and there clearly is law enforcement intelligence, but changing their behavior is a very difficult part of this, and that's what we're trying to do with this toolbox.
And the deck was reshuffled now with his son coming into power, and the recent detonation of what I think we're pretty sure was an underground nuclear test. Do you think that's going to stimulate China to take a more active
role? Well, we hope so. And I think part of the thing is it clearly is not in China's interest to have a nuclear power next to them. But they are very worried that the whole place will fall apart and that millions of refugees will stream into China. So they are loath to do anything. They also, in many ways, see North Korea as a buffer against our ally, South Korea. But there have been different attempts to try to figure that. Kim Dae-jung, who was the president of South Korea, was trying something called the Sunshine Policy, which was an attempt to have some kind of a relationship with the North Koreans to show them that they could have a better life. That did not work. And by the way, I have to tell one part of the story. When I was there on this trip, it was like November 2000, and I'm sitting at dinner with Kim Jong-il, and this is all through translators, and He talks to me about, wouldn't it be interesting to have the Swedish model, and I couldn't figure out which model he was talking about. And then all of a sudden he turns to me and he says, how does my translator compare with Kim Dae-jung's? And this was all through the translator. And I thought, I'm going to have this guy killed. Yeah. So I said, which was the truth, that Kim Dae-jung had the best woman interpreter I'd ever heard, but you have a great interpreter also. Yeah. And then he said, I would like to have Korean Americans come here and teach people English. So we had any number of interesting conversations. But there are different ways that people thought one could do something about North Korea. This young man, we don't even know how old he really is, I think is trying to prove that he is also divinely anointed out of this hereditary dictatorship. And he is trying to develop his relationship with the military. And so that, I think, is part of what is going on. But one would hope that we think that the Chinese are the ones that have the most influence because they do deliver fuel to them.
And they're right next door.
Yeah.
You referred earlier, and several of the questions are around this, and the reason I'm tying it back is you talked about at the time you first learned about your possible Jewish ancestry, you were trying to establish yourself as a woman Secretary of State. And several people ask, what were some of the values that you think perhaps put you at an advantage by being the first woman Secretary of State?
Well, first of all, it now seems kind of strange. This is a question about my youngest granddaughter lives in San Francisco, and she was like 3 years ago when she was seven. She said, so what's the big deal about Grandma Maddie being Secretary of State? Only girls are Secretary of State. So in her lifetime. What happened when my name was out there, people thought that a woman could not be Secretary of State, and partially in terms of dealing with Arab leaders. So what happened was that the Arab ambassadors at the UN kind of got together and put out a statement and said, we had no problems dealing with Ambassador Albright. We would have no problems dealing with Secretary Albright. So I'm named Secretary of State, and I actually go over to the Gulf Cooperation Council meetings. I did arrive in a very large plane that said United States of America. And then when I was after the meeting that I had with these ministers, I said, perhaps you haven't noticed, but I'm dressed differently than my predecessors. You've been very kind to me, and next time we'll talk about women's rights. And we actually did. I had more problems with the men in our own government.
Not surprised.
Yeah, not because they were male chauvinist pigs, but because they had watched me through my very long career evolution. So I'd been the carpool mother and a friend of their wife's and somebody who had them over for dinner, and then I was a staffer a long time. I'd done an awful lot of Xeroxing and making coffee, and so they thought, how did she get to be Secretary of State? But I think that there are advantages. I'm not somebody that believes the world would be totally different if it were run by women. Anybody who thinks that has forgotten high school. But I do think that there are a lot about negotiation is about being able to put yourself into the other person's shoes. And I think women are pretty good in terms of empathy and trying to build consensus. And I think there were advantages. I would arrive somewhere and you'd have normal kind of conversations and very nice. And then I would say, I have come a long way, so I must be frank. And then, so a little bit of disarming. And then, but I think that there are ways that there are some advantages. I would never have been Secretary of State if it hadn't been for Hillary. And the reason I know that is that President Clinton said so publicly. We used to do this kind of thing where we would go abroad and I would introduce her and she would introduce him. And he said, you know, what happened was that during this period that Hillary had come to him and said, why wouldn't you name Madeleine? She is the person that most of anybody supports your views and she expresses them better than anybody else. Besides, it would make your mother very happy. So that is how it happened.
Yeah. Well, we have to get to Syria. I'm not even going to phrase that as a question. I'm going to phrase it as a noun and let you go where you think that can
Syria.
Go.
I think that, first of all, I do think it's important to put it kind of into the context, what's happening in the Arab world. And I had been in a very interesting discussion with an Arab at Georgetown publicly, and this was last winter, and I said, well, we can't call it the Arab Spring because it's the winter, so let's call it the Arab Awakening. And he said, that is outrageous and very rude to the Arabs. We have not been asleep all this time. And I said, so what would you call it? And he said, I would call it Arab Troubles. And I said, what about Arab Opportunities? So in those several phrases, it shows the complications of it. So Syria, which had been a very powerful country, basically, in the region, but run by Assad family, Alawites, which is a minority sect within Syria, and cruel, I think, in many ways, and all of a sudden all this upheaval takes place, and it has affected Syria. I think it is a very tragic situation that is going on, and a very dangerous one, because this is a country, we are as a whole looking at a massive fight in the Middle East, some between groupings of Muslims. I think most Americans hadn't even thought about Sunni and Shia, but we are looking at a massive schism in Islam as it tries to figure out how to operate in the 21st century. In addition to that, you have a problem of the linkage with the Iranians. So you have the Persians and the Arabs trying to sort things out. And also, it is affecting the whole region, so that what is happening threatening Jordan and causing problems for Turkey. So as a regional issue, it is very serious. And then 60,000 people who have been killed. The international community, I think, is trying to deal with this. The United States, and I think partially, to analogize a bit from my book, we are tired from Iraq and Afghanistan. And also, I think that there is a sense that other countries can also help. The United States actually has provided quite a lot of humanitarian, non-lethal assistance, helping with the refugees and any number of things, and also providing communications and help. And also, we have been instrumental in getting support for this opposition group and getting them recognized. So I think we are playing our part. I think it is very hard to imagine that we would put boots on the ground in Syria. But I do think that the situation is being assessed and reassessed all along. I can tell you from how the system works is there is a decision-making group, a principals committee, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, under the auspices of the National Security Advisor, that meets all the time, makes recommendations to the president, but the president ultimately makes the decisions. But what you do, and all I can do is talk about what it was like in the Balkans, is you keep reassessing things and trying to figure out what more you can do to change the situation. And from what I can tell, that's what's going on now. There are attempts to try to keep pushing so that the opposition group can, in fact, get Assad out. The question is whether we should be arming the opposition group. And it is also my understanding that the problem isn't that there are not enough arms in there. They have been getting arms. I think the problem is more trying to get them to consolidate themselves and have one view and begin to try to figure out how to get Assad to talk to them, and then diplomatically to get the Russians to figure out that they're on the wrong side of this story. And I think that's one of the things that's going on as we speak.
Yeah, that's from my very innocent spot, that strikes me as a huge part of the problem is the Russian opposition. I apologize to everyone for not getting to all of your questions, but there is one more question that will be our last question, and several people clearly have read your book, Read My Pen, So I wonder, for the people sitting in the back particularly, but generally, if you could explain the pin that you're wearing for us
well,
tonight.
First of all, I have to tell you how this all started. I would not have a pin collection if it weren't for Saddam Hussein. And and how it began was, I, as I said earlier, when I went to the United Nations, my job was to make sure that the sanctions stayed on. And so my instructions were to say perfectly terrible things about Saddam Hussein constantly, which he deserved. He had invaded Kuwait. So after a while, a poem appeared in the papers in Baghdad comparing me to many things, but among them, an unparalleled serpent. So I had a snake pin, and I wore it when we were talking about Iraq. So I think you've all seen how the ambassadors go out and talk to the press after a meeting. So all of a sudden, the camera zeroes in on the snake pin. It says, why are you wearing the snake pin? And I said, because Saddam Hussein compared me to an unparalleled serpent. And then I thought, well, this is fun. So I went out, and I bought a bunch of costume jewelry, some pins to indicate what I thought was going to happen on any given day. So on good days, I wore flowers and butterflies and balloons, and on bad days, all kinds of insects and carnivorous animals. And it was right after the first President Bush had said, read my lips, no new taxes. So I said, read my pins, when they asked what we were going to do. So that's how it began. I did add them to this toolbox, and I would send messages with my pins. So, for instance, what happened once, we found that the Russians had been actually eavesdropping on us at the State Department. They had bugged the State Department. And in a conference room right by the secretary, my office, by the secretary's office. So we did what diplomats do, which is demarche, go to Moscow and say, you shouldn't be doing this. But the next time I met with the Russians, I wore this huge bug, and they knew exactly what I was doing. So my pin tonight is actually of Prague. And it is something that I bought at a flea market in Prague. And for those of you that have been there, it's the view up at the castle. So I thought it was an appropriate pin to wear.
Well, thank you. And you've answered the question now for many people.
Thank you.
Madeline and Roy, I want to thank you very much for a very interesting and also entertaining conversation. And Madeline, I particularly want to thank you for your very candid comments. I, for one, appreciated them very much. I hope you all enjoyed the program tonight presented by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. I know I did. Madeline Albright, once again, her new book is Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance in War, 1937-48. And now, I want to thank you for joining us and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club celebrating 110 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.